From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Lines are reported at polling places throughout Southern California. No surprise, given unusually high interest for midterm election. Southern California is key in determining which party controls the House. We'll bring you live reports from polling locations, talk with our local registrars, and bring you the essence of this important day. We'll get to it right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is December 1st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to be with you today on the big day in Southern California. We are finally here. Months of talking about what will transpire today. So this is the place for day-long and nighttime coverage of the national midterm and the California statewide elections. We're, of course, working hand-in-glove with NPR. Their correspondents and analysts will be with us throughout the afternoon and evening hours. And Libby Dankman and I will be anchoring KPCC's local election night coverage with the returns first. There's no middle person, no producer who has to load in the graphics and have that time delay. We get it to you first. All of the election results, starting with the Libby and me at 8 o'clock, but it starts hours before that with Nick Roman and NPR right here on KPCC. And in fact, if you want to experience us in person, our KPCC in-person team invites you to our Crawford Family Forum in Pasadena. Democracy and Donuts, it's an election day drop by. You can wear your I voted sticker, get free coffee, donuts, and pastries, then stick around, talk with some of our staff members. I was in earlier today and had the pleasure of talking with some of our listeners who had just voted nearby and stopped in to pick up a donut and a cup of coffee. You can get more information about how to get to our Crawford Family Forum by visiting kpecc.org/in-person. Well, first, in this 10 o'clock hour, we begin by checking in what's going on at local polling locations. We begin with the Orange County Registrar of Voters, Neil Kelly. Neil, thank you for checking in with us today.
Larry, thanks for having me.
So how are things going at your county's polling locations so far?
It's going well. We had a good opening, and I was just commenting to somebody else that our calls for service are actually below what they have been in other elections. So overall, very good.
That's good. What of the complaints that you've received, what's been the nature of them so far?
I'll give you a great example. Poll workers are struggling to figure out how to get the voting booths working, and we send teams out there and found out they hadn't plugged them in. So it's those kinds of things, which are, it may sound simple, but to get the polling places up and running, that's what we go through.
Now, in the training, they are instructed to plug in the booths, right? Okay. All right.
I think sometimes when it gets busy, you know, and I love our poll workers, but they do get flustered at times, and then we stabilize.
And everybody panics because the stakes are so high. It's like, well, what if it doesn't work and people aren't there? So was there any delay with people being able to cast their ballots at that location?
Yeah, we had a couple of small delays, but again, they stabilized pretty quickly. And out of 1,000 polling places, right around 7:30, we had 30 incidents that we were addressing. And so I think, you know, overall, that's very good.
Have you had any instances where people have been electioneering close to a polling location? Your staff has had to move them farther down the block, that sort of thing?
We have responded to a few of those, and just, in fact, 10 minutes ago, responded to one where somebody put a sign up on the polling place entrance.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, that those things happen, and we've been responding.
Okay. And is it just you think people don't know, or sometimes they do know but are trying to see what they can get away with?
I think it's a combination of both.
All right. And jumping ahead to tonight, can you give us a sense of, you know, what returns you expect to have, what time of the evening?
So we've been caught up until today, which I'll talk about in just a second, with all of our ballot scanning for what's been received, which is a little over 400,000. So that's what we were reported at 8:05. But in today's mail, 50,000 ballots arrived. That's historic, Larry. I've never seen 50,000 arrive on a Tuesday for a midterm, ever. In fact, that's close to presidential volume.
Wow, 50,000 in one day. So is there any chance those can be counted during the day today and be part of that 805 first report?
I would love to do that. We are starting to process those, but to process 50,000 through the entire system takes about 36 hours.
Okay. So some of those will go through, but not all of them.
Correct.
Okay. And what is the deadline? Is it received by the end, by the polls closing tonight, either at a polling location or via mail, or is there any allowance made for postmarking?
So there's an allowance made for postmarking. If they mail it today and it's postmarked and we receive it by Friday, there's no problem. It will count. The other thing that I suggest to folks is if you see a vote sign, you're driving down the street, pull into any location and you can drop off that ballot.
Okay. And then when do you think we'll start having some precinct results in your tabulations tonight?
We have posted our schedule as 9:30. I'm pretty confident we'll have some at that time. And then really you'll start seeing those come in pretty large waves around 10:30, 11 o'clock, because that's when the poll workers start closing down. But keep in mind, if it's any indication based on turnout now, we might have some lines tonight, which could extend that a little bit.
Okay. If you do have some significant lines at 8 o'clock closing time, would you allow the people who are lined up to cast their votes even if the vote is physically cast after 8?
Absolutely. So if they're in line by 8 o'clock, they will be able to vote no matter what time it is. It extends to. So just be in line by 8 o'clock.
And are you concerned, given that this turnout's kind of mind-boggling, that you might be understaffed at some place? Are there any way that you could bulk it up today, or is it too late to do that?
No, we've been planning for this for a year, knowing that there was a lot of indicators that there was going to be some strong turnout and heavy engagement. But in looking at the numbers, Larry, as of 9 a.m., our turnout's almost even with 2014. So the polling place turnout has surprised me a little bit. All of the vote-by-mail ballots and early in-person voting have been historic. But this is interesting data I'm seeing right now.
So, but the at polling location is not up from 2014. So that would mean it's lower than 2016, I assume.
That's correct. So this same time period in 2016, we had an 8% polling place turnout. This morning, I've got 2.24%, which is just 0.2% ahead of 14.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Big difference. So you may have in total more overall voters once all is said and done, but this just speaks to the conversion of voters to the mail process.
I think you're exactly on point with that.
Okay. Now, in Orange County, your jurisdiction, there are a number of congressional races that are expected to be very, very close. What's sort of the outside time period that it might take to determine a winner?
Based on what I think is going to happen, which will be large volumes dropped off of the polling place, this could go on for 10 or 15 days. Obviously, we're going to be focusing our attention on close contests to be able to advance those. But we just ask for people's patience because of the large volume here in California. You know, that could go on for 15 or 20 days.
Wow. So some of these races, we might not know who the member of Congress for the next term is until middle of next week.
Even further than that, possibly, Larry, just depending on how many ballots were dropped off in those districts and how close the contest is.
All right. Neil Kelly, I know you're extremely busy today. It sounds like not maybe as busy as you could have been because things are going well. But thanks so much. Really appreciate your taking the time.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. Orange County Registrar of Voters Neil Kelly joining us on Air Talk. So let's take a look at what's happening in Los Angeles County. KPCC's Sharon McNary was just at the Church of the Hills in Sylmar. She is en route to Marie Sendak Elementary Library in North Hollywood. Sharon, what did you see at the church in Sylmar?
Well, what I saw was a very steady progression of voters. And, I do a lot of election days at polling places. I really enjoy going out and seeing people vote. And I have to tell you, I'm not seeing like a huge larger number of voters than I have in the past. So I think that what Registrar Neil Kelly is saying about like the higher number of vote by mails, the higher number of early voting, I think that's where you're going to see your big increase, not necessarily at the polls, because I'm seeing about what I would see at any other election.
Did you hear him say, Sharon, I don't know, because you were driving, that in Orange County, as of today, or prior to today, they'd received 400,000 vote-by-mail ballots?
You know, people do not want to miss this election, and the sure way to do it is to put that thing in the mail early or vote early. My husband tried to vote early on Sunday in Pasadena, and the process was excruciatingly slow. So he left and he voted in person this morning. But yeah, the enthusiasm is up, even if the numbers I'm seeing at the polls seem about even from previous elections.
All right. So you're going to Sendak Elementary School Library in North Hollywood, and you can check out, see what's going on there. Were you elsewhere before you were at Church of the Hills?
Yeah, I was in Santa Clarita, and that was an interesting place because I was there when the polls opened. In fact, I recorded the poll inspector making that announcement they do that the polls are now open. Everybody gets treated to that at 7 a.m., wherever polling place you go to. And there were 11 people in line there to vote. And they had just a steady stream of voters, every single booth occupied for about the first hour that I was there. And then it petered off because people have to go to work. And so that's why early in the day voting is so heavy.
All right. And as we just heard from Neil Kelly in Orange County, there's going to be the ability to vote, even if people get in line just prior to 8 o'clock. And if they're not able to physically cast a vote by 8, that's OK. If you're in line by 8 o'clock, you will still be able to vote. Sharon, did you get a sense whether there were very many people who had to request provisional ballots, or did it seem when you were in Sylmar and Santa Clarita that the people who were there to vote, their registration was in order?
I didn't see a lot of irregularities. I didn't see a lot of people complaining that their names were not on the voter roster. But that's really just two polling places, so it's hardly representative. And as you know, voting is going to change in Los Angeles County for the next big election. We're going to be voting or dropping off ballots at these scattered community voting centers. It's no longer walk down the block to your neighborhood school. So a lot of people will be saying goodbye to the places they've known and voted at for years and years, me included. I'll be taking my dog to go vote at the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Pasadena later today.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, it's going to be different next time, 2 years from now, not having a neighborhood polling place to go to. Sharon, thanks very much. We'll look forward to your reports throughout the day here on KPCC.
Thanks very much.
KPCC's correspondent Sharon McNearly, typically covering infrastructure, but out there on Election Day. Also with us, Kaylee Wells, our KPCC reporter, brand new, just joining us at 89.3. She's in Buena Park in Orange County at the Dysinger Elementary School. Kaylee, good to have you with us.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So share with us what you're seeing there in Buena Park.
Sure. So, yeah, I am at an elementary school in a neighborhood, kind of like that traditional picture that Sharon just painted. This is almost exclusively a household. I don't really even know if there are apartments in the Buena Park neighborhood. Here at the elementary school, I'd say, you know, it's not out the door, but the school's small visitor parking lot is full. And it looks like the classroom where the ballots are actually being cast is never empty. So not longer than I would have expected, but no bad signs either.
All right. And have you had a chance to talk with some of the voters, just get a sense of sort of their degree of interest in voting today? Sometimes people do it dutifully, and other times there's enthusiasm to vote.
Sure. I would say this time I'm seeing a lot of enthusiasm on both sides of the aisle. I've spoken to some Democratic voters that have talked about how it's time for a change. They're concerned about the state of the country. They're concerned about issues like affordable health care, immigration, things like that, and they want to see a switch. I also spoke to retiree Gordon Myers. He's actually the last one I just spoke to. And he said he was also inspired by the 2016 election, but he likes the direction the country's headed, and he came out because he wants to keep a good thing going. And I'm here in the 39th district, which is one of those really contested districts that we're talking about. Republican Ed Royce, he just announced that he's retiring, so we don't have an incumbent in this election. He said he's going to miss him, but he's still voting Republican for Young Kim. That would be the Republican that would replace him if she is able to defeat Gil Cisneros.
Yeah, this is one of those seats expected to be a very close race. Gil Cisneros, the Democrat, Young Kim, who was a staffer for Ed Royce for a number of years, looking to keep that in the GOP column, the 39th. North Orange County also includes a portion of southeastern L.A. County and a portion of San Bernardino County as well. Kaylee, anything else to add before I let you go?
I think I feel pretty good. It's sort of the same theme you're seeing in all of the Orange County districts here, or some of the Orange County districts here, that, you know, Hillary Clinton won it back in 2016. And so you have a lot of Dems hoping for that blue wave. But the voter registration, at least in this part of town, is pretty evenly split. So I guess we'll see later in the day.
All right. Thanks so much, Kaylee Wells, KPECC new general assignment reporter in Buena Park at Deisinger Elementary School. Coming up, speaking of schools, we'll talk about a proposal that is apparently being prepared by Austin Buettner, the fairly new LAUSD superintendent, that would split the district into more than 30 neighborhood clusters of schools. In all the years I've been hosting the program, been through many proposals to decentralize LA Unified. They've all hit snags in various ways. We'll talk about what's different in this possibility. We'll be back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope all is going very well. Busy day today with voting, but there's other news, too. We're going to spend time looking at the future of the L.A. Unified School District in a piece co-reported yesterday in the Los Angeles Times by education reporter Howard Bloom. Austin Buettner, the fairly new superintendent of the L.A. Unified School District, is apparently drafting a plan that would decentralize the district, moving decision-making authority from the central headquarters out into more than 30 neighborhood clusters of schools. The idea being that this would not just save money in a district that is expected to be significantly cash-strapped, but also to enable efficiency in decision-making and customization in meeting the educational needs of neighborhoods within the sprawling L.A. district. With us, L.A. Times reporter Howard Bloom. Howard, good to have you with us again. Howard, you there? Okay, we'll try and get Howard back on momentarily and see what Howard has to say. Also with us is Katie Browdy, who's executive director of the parent organization Speak Up. Katie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. Glad to be here.
So share with us, since we don't have Howard quite yet, based on your understanding of these clusters, what do you see as the advantages?
Well, I think any time we move more resources to the schools or closer to the schools, we're moving in the right direction. I think it's been one of the biggest issues that we face. There's an overblown bureaucracy right now at LAUSD, and even with declining enrollment, the bureaucracy has increased, and LAUSD's had to get waivers from the state to account for having too many administrators. So I think that it's definitely a good plan. Obviously, we don't know the details yet, but the idea that we can be giving more decision-making power to the local school sites, and where the school leaders and the teachers and parents can really know, the ones who know best what's best for kids at that school, that's going to be a good thing.
Are you concerned about the potential that in each of these clusters that they sort of build up their own administration, and that you could end up with a higher cost through duplicating services that are now able to be streamlined?
Yeah, obviously that is a concern. So it really depends on how it's rolled out. If the intent is to put the decision-making power at the schools, then the local clusters could serve as resources rather than compliance makers.
All right. Joining us is Katie Browdy of Speak Up, executive director of that parental organization. Now we have Howard Bloom, Los Angeles Times reporter. Howard, good morning.
Good morning. Sorry about that. I had my mute button on.
That's quite all right. So you were talking, but we couldn't hear. So, you've been around long enough, maybe not as long as I have, but we've been through a number of these proposals to decentralize and to put the autonomy much closer to the school site. What's your sense of what, if anything, is different in what Buettner's working on here?
Well, I think some of it is not different because, as you've pointed out, there have been a number of attempts to decentralize the district. And, I guess it must not be easy to do that, or it would have been accomplished already. And what's different this time? I mean, I think there may be a serious effort here to look at how much you can make local district schools function more like independent charter schools, which have their own boards of directors. They channel their own donations to the schools. They do their own hiring and have much more control over their budget. So if we're talking about that level of decentralization, that would be a sea change, although it isn't clear that LA Unified's personnel has been trained to be those kind of principals, those kind of leaders. But there are people who just say, we've been there, done that, and they're not that impressed by the concept, at least.
More than 20 years ago, there was a proposal, and I wish I could recall the name, but it was a very far-reaching proposal for the district to train every principal to essentially, at her or his school site, be the backstop to make the decisions to allocate where their school's funding. The idea was that they would get the block of what their funding is, and then the principal would really determine. The idea was to totally get this at the local school level. The problem they had, as I understand it, among other things, was really training principals to be able to take that on in addition to all the other responsibilities. And I wonder if one of the concerns about this decentralization, even if it's not going directly to the school site, if you've got a cluster that's just a few schools, K through 12, are you going to have people with the financial sophistication to be able to make those decisions knowing all the facts?
Right, and I know the plan you're talking about, Larry, was the LEARN reform.
LEARN, thank you, yes.
Oh, yeah, I reported on that one way back when as I think I was 3 years old at the time, but I was precocious. that one fell apart, and part of the reason it fell apart was that principals weren't ready to take control, and that was not just about principals calling the shots. It was about the school community partnering with the principal to call the shots, and the central office, there was turnover there. There were new leaders that weren't that committed to that process. And that was just before the charter school movement really began to take hold in Los Angeles. But there was even a previous, they call them networks now, but there was a time when the district was divided into 32 clusters, the very same number they're proposing now. And those clusters were supposed to have all sorts of autonomy. And that plan kind of didn't go anywhere, although it was announced with great fanfare.
Well, and so in that one where they used 32 neighborhood clusters, what happened there? Is it just a matter that finding 32 people who were qualified and trained to make those decisions, you can't get 32 people, or is there something systemic that seems to be more than having the administrative talent to pull it off?
Well, that is a good question. I think part of it was the district was not ready. They came up with a grand plan, but they didn't have an execution strategy. And people were not bought into it, both at the central office level, where people did not want to give up their jobs or give up control, and then at the local level. There were some principals who didn't feel prepared to take that on and didn't want to take that on. So they rolled out a big idea, but they didn't have a strategy to carry it out. And I do think Austin Buettner's team is sensitive to that issue, and they're going to try to come up with something that is more workable. Some of them are students of history. But again, if it was easy to fix the LA Unified School District, it would have been fixed a long time ago, because most people in there are trying to do a good job. It's not as though they're trying to do a bad job.
We're talking with LA Times reporter Howard Bloom. He and a colleague broke the story yesterday that the superintendent of the LA Unified School District, Austin Buettner, is drafting a plan to split the district into 32 neighborhood clusters, where the autonomy for running those schools of affinity serving specific neighborhoods, where those decisions would be made. And I'd like to hear from you, particularly if you're a stakeholder in the district, a parent, if you are a former LAUSD student, if you're someone who just closely followed the district, what do you think of this idea? Of course, on the one end, you have people who say this massive district, second largest in the country, is simply too big to efficiently manage. And also their argument is it's become top-heavy administratively. And they argue that splitting it up would help to deal with both of those issues, the massive size, the difficulty managing a district of that size, and also the ossification of large administration. But those on the other side say, we've been down this road before. There just is not an efficient way, effective way to do it. Plus, you end up potentially duplicating administrative functions that could be consolidated in one place. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, consultant David Tarkovsky, former member of the LAUSD board, a former teacher in the district, and he is with Associated Administrators of Los Angeles, representing principals and other administrators. David, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the discussion so far.
So David, what's your sense as you look at this? First of all, the negatives. What do you think would be the problem implementing this?
Well, invariably, it chews up 2 or 3 years of distraction from curriculum and instruction as people learn their new boss and how they're supposed to do things. And that's 3 years of kids' education. I agree with you. We've been down this road. There's lots of duplication that starts to happen. The costs end up being more than the savings. And it really is more of a mantra of campaign that we should drain the swamp or decrease the bureaucracy. These are rhetorical terms that even I've used as I ran for office. But once you get in office, you have to learn and govern and focus on what is important. And training your people, getting the best teachers, retaining those teachers, and building the leadership, that's what, in fact, Learn tried to do. They did their whole reform movement in public, not in private, like this document that Howard was able to get. And the training was essential. You have to invest in your human capital. So, and even then, the Learn reform had a significant Learn Central office to assist the locals once they were trained when conflicts arose. But my particular view is, besides HR, that it's all about instruction and encouraging teachers, administrators, principals, and families to be excited about learning rather than moaning about the swamp.
Now, given that you're a consultant with the administrators organization, I can probably guess your answer, but do you think the district potentially is too top-heavy with administrators?
No, I think administration can be part of accountability. And, you know, I think we always fear in the United States that something is too large. I went to vote this morning. And, of course, when we got to Proposition 9, we couldn't vote. That was the item that asked us to break the huge state of California into 3 states and was ruled unconstitutional and removed from the ballot. There were people in 1860 who thought the country was too large and divided it into 2 countries. All of this produces friction and distraction and segregation. And that is a key element. Ms. Browdy from the Palisades, Malibu area, that's a different world than your Montebellos, your Linwoods, your Antelope Valleys, Inglewood, and even Pasadena, where the station is. Nobody is proposing that the troubles of Pasadena Unified should be resolved by breaking the 3 high schools into separate networks.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation. That's David Tukofsky, Katie Browdy with us also from Speak Up, the parents group, Howard Bloom, L.A. Times education reporter, and we'll be hearing the union perspective from Alex Caputo-Pearl of UTLA. That's coming up. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3, back after this live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Couple of minutes, we'll take your calls on LAUSD. According to the LA Times, Austin Buettner, the new superintendent in LA, is drafting a plan to break the district up into 32 neighborhood clusters to allow those neighborhood schools to be more autonomous in their decision making and in their priorities. The idea is that it would save costs at the central administrative level and also allow for a more nimble local educational experience. With us, Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of United Teachers Los Angeles, representing the thousands of educators in LA Unified. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So your response to this proposal we expect to receive soon?
Well, I've been a teacher in South LA and Compton for 22 years. I'm a parent of LAUSD students. I've been through this several times in terms of reorganizing the district. But this one's different. This is more of a corporate takeover with students as collateral damage than it is a real decentralization. So we have several concerns with this. One is transparency. Austin Buettner developed this plan working with unaccountable consultants that are paid for by Eli Broad and his foundation, a well-known privatizer of public schools. And worse, these consultants who he's working with, which include Katamba and Third Way, and others, these are folks who do not have a track record of success with students and have actually moved the privatization of other districts using a concept called portfolio district. And that term is literally taken from like when investors work with a diversified portfolio on Wall Street. But here they're talking about working with a diversified set of private operators who take over schools, outside groups who take over schools. Schools instead of the district. So we've seen their work in New Orleans, Washington, D.C., Detroit, Newark. Many of them have been run out of town in those cities because of serious problems with equity, taking away centralized oversight over student equity, civil rights, learning conditions. When you hand stuff over to private operators instead of an elected school board and a school district that knows something about education and knows something about the city, then you run into those problems with equity, civil rights, and learning conditions.
But our school boards are supposed to be providing oversight of the charters as well, right? Because they're public schools and they have to be certified by the Board of Education.
And this has been a strategy, this portfolio district strategy has been one that's been used by folks like Eli Broad, Reed Hastings of Netflix, other billionaires who have gotten involved in public education. It's been used to undermine the authority of elected school boards. If you go on Eli Broad's website, he calls elected school boards, which is interesting on election day, calls elected school boards an obstacle to real change for students. So what we need, what Austin Buettner is doing here is he's creating austerity. He's not spending a $1.86 billion reserve on the immediate needs of students in terms of class size reduction, getting nurses and counselors into schools, et cetera, creating that austerity by withholding that reserve and using austerity as a pretext to create this portfolio district, to create this illusion of choice, which really just actually reinforces segregation and does this kind of corporate takeover mentality. So we are very concerned about this proposal.
We're talking with Alex Caputo-Pearl, United Teachers Los Angeles. We go back to Speak Up, the parent organization, executive director, Katie Browdy. A brief response to what Mr. Caputo-Pearl was just saying.
Well, first of all, he maybe has more details about this plan than I do because I haven't heard anything about portfolio district or any of these other issues. I can speak from the perspective of our parents in South LA and East LA and pretty much all over the district. And they feel that they don't have enough local control and local decision-making power at their school sites, and that there should be a lot more ability to have resources at the school sites. When they think about the bureaucracy downtown, it's far. It's just a, it's, you know, if they need to get to the school district central, to someone who makes decisions, that's a real trek for them if they live in most parts of the school district.
All right.
So getting the decision-making apparatus closer to the school sites, as well as putting more resources at the school sites, is important.
Let me take a listener call. Wendy in Playa del Rey, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I would like to respond to both the head of the teachers union and also the gentleman who was the consultant for administrators. I'm a former LAUSD teacher. I also worked in Manhattan Beach City Schools, and I've been a principal of a charter school, and I've been an administrator in private schools. And I have to tell you that after 45 years of experience, education is not scalable. The gentleman that talked about training teacher principals and, you know, keeping everything large so that we can make decisions. There were no decisions, there were no principals that I worked for in LA Unified, except for one who was on his way out. He retired a year after I got there, who were able to make effective decisions for the students that I taught and for the schools. And I don't know Buettner's plan. I don't know the specifics of it, but I know that as a teacher in LA Unified, the most problems that I saw had to do with the power brokerage between the unions and the board. No one was focusing on what was going on in the schools and how they could help children.
If it was broken into clusters, how would you see that playing out? I mean, because you're describing principles you didn't think were particularly effective and good decision makers. So if the authority is closer to the principal, you see that as destructive.
It had to do with the district systems. There are these systems that are embedded in the unified school district. Principals, rather than exercising the kind of leadership that principals need to have, which means you're going to have people who don't like you, which means that you're going to be fighting for things. Those are the good principals. And what principals do now in LA Unified is they wait in line for a plum off-campus administrative position. There is a ton of money that needs to be cut in Beaudry. Those people are all people who were principals and who did faux reforms so that their supervisors would know who they were. I had one principal who I had 30 kids in a magnet school, and he was being observed by his supervisor. So he got me a TA for the day so that I could show him what a real classroom looked like. Well, I didn't have that TA the rest of the day.
That was for show, not go. All right. I appreciate it, Wendy. Thanks very much. Let's talk with Sylvia in South Los Angeles. I understand you're also a retired teacher. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, Larry, I've been with LA Unified for 32 years. I went through the Learn reform that David Tarkovsky spoke about. I've been through other reforms. At that time, they broke it up into 16 clusters, and it was disastrous. Why? Because you become disconnected, and because the power that was given to that specific superintendent for that specific cluster was used to bring in people and do policies and things that had nothing to do with anything. What the district needs to understand is that the situation that they have now, where they have the local districts for each of the areas, south, east, west, northeast, northwest, that serves the specific communities. You don't need anything more than that.
Okay.
That becomes your administration. It doesn't have anything to do with going down to Beaudry. That becomes your administration.
All right.
That specific area. So going down to Beaudry, Beaudry doesn't need to be there. It needs to be much.
You think five sub-districts are sufficient? Sylvia, I appreciate it. I'm sorry, I do need to break. But Sylvia, retired teacher, L.A. Unified School District, and concerned about the proposal, as reported in the L.A. Times, for taking the authority that's vested in Beaudry at the district headquarters or in these five sub-districts and moving that to neighborhood clusters, 32 of them reportedly under consideration. We'll continue our conversation. Many more listeners want to weigh in on this. Should the LA Unified School District diversify, send the power into 32 neighborhood clusters, or keep the status quo? We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You're going to hear a lot of me today. You'll be sick of me by the time we get to midnight. Not only hosting Air Talk today, but I'll be back with you tonight with Libby Denkman, and we'll bring you continuing election coverage. Just to remind you, we have the returns first right here on KPCC. There's no middle person. We're able to get it immediately, just as soon as they're released, and Libby and I will share those results with you as the returns come in. So you'll get it first, you'll get it accurate, and analysis of what's going on as well. It's from our local team here at KPCC and NPR, as we'll interweave the coverage. It all starts this afternoon, actually on All Things Considered, then into the special NPR election coverage at 5, and Libby and I will take to the airwaves at 8 o'clock. Nick Roman is here, the whole KPCC news team. That's all coming up tonight right here on 89.3. KPCC. Then tomorrow, a statewide call-in program I'll be hosting from here in Southern California. It'll be heard, tell your friends. It'll be on public radio stations up and down the Golden State. KQED San Francisco, KPBS San Diego, Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Up in Chico, in the Central Valley, our 11 o'clock hour will be picked up statewide as part of the California Dream Project, and I'll be taking listener calls from throughout the state. That's on the election results tomorrow right here on KPCC. Stu in Santa Monica, I understand you're a former cluster administrator. So what do you think about this proposal of breaking it up into 32 neighborhood clusters now?
I think it's a wonderful idea. And I think, if I remember correctly, there were 27 clusters, not 32. And each reported to a decentralized superintendent. We were like small superintendents I had about 38 schools at the time. But the discussion, you have to split away, learn from this decentralization in the clusters. Learn was a good idea. It decentralized decision-making and made parents and teachers very powerful in those decisions. Regrettably, it didn't provide any accountability. So if there was an administrator who disagreed with the decision of the group, he or she was responsible for the decision if there was failure. So there has to be some concern with regard to that. With regard to the clusters, they were really good. Unfortunately, they were not funded equitably. I had two consultants that I could work with to serve 38 schools, and it really prohibited us. So, by the way, I just wanted to say thanks to David Tikoski. We had worked together at the time. So the cluster has to have decision-making and accountability for where decisions are made. I think the idea is really great. The district, I recall, is about 720 square miles. There's differences in the needs of Canoga Park and San Pedro, West LA,
yeah,
LA, and so forth.
All right. Stu, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Was in the former administrative position for one of these clusters. So David Tikoski, he sees it a little differently than you, even though you two had worked together back in the day. So Stu thinks as long as this is, really funded and the follow-through is there, it makes sense. Your response?
Well, absolutely. If this is Austin Buettner learning about all the different things that have happened before as he develops his plan,
power to him. But really, this is like repeating things over and over again. This is like we haven't heard the word history, reading, math, science, physics, architecture, teachers, early ed. It's as if Kaiser Hospital were decentralizing itself and not talking about health, medical training, and so on. So we're focusing on governance and structure rather than the real meat and potatoes of learning. And that's what I object so far to the piece of leaked is we're retreading it,
okay.
We're reforming it, we're doing it all over again, rather than moving forward to what really matters, the teachers, the principals, the families, and the content of learning.
Let me take a parental perspective here. Let's see, this comes, Mike in Beverly Hills, you're an LAUSD parent, is that right?
Hi, Larry. No, I'm sorry.
Oh.
Have kids yet, so let me just say, as someone who is planning on having kids and intends to move into LAUSD because it is a large district, because it is a democratic institution, the idea that it would be broken up into 32 districts, to me that just proposes that they're just going to completely explode the existing segregation and racial segregation, economic segregation that already exists in LA. If you want to know what this will end up looking like, we already have a picture of it in our communities. Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, Culver City, Manhattan Beach, all the coastal communities, you have a consolidation of resources, a consolidation of the desirable teachers, the sports facilities, the new classrooms, the new LCD screens, and you have urban schools that are being neglected and left to rot.
They actually get more funding, though. So what's going on?
But, Larry, they're getting funding to address existing inequality, and that funding is supposed to pay for school lunches, breakfast in the morning to pay for special education.
No, but that's separate stuff. Yeah, because those have designated areas of funding. David, can you briefly speak to that point?
Yeah, absolutely, Warren. You are right that there are compensatory fundings from the state and the federal for doing some piece of the helping of poverty. But as Gavin Newsom has been emphasizing during this entire campaign, that we have not finished our battles to improve society and ameliorate poverty. He focuses on early education, again, something we haven't talked about here at all, because we're talking about structure and governance. What we really need to be doing is, like Burbank Unified on the ballot today, is going out and asking the voters of Burbank to support a parcel tax. The governor has done a good job about rainy day fund, but that rainy day fund of $15 billion legally, 40% of that should be returned to the K-12 schools. That is a $6 billion figure that is being held up in Sacramento and not returned to do the improvements of instruction, battle poverty.
David, did you call me Warren? I've only known you for, 25 years or something?
I did not have an espresso this morning.
Okay, that's no excuse.
And
it's not like we don't know each other. All right.
Sorry, I've crossed the line of public radio and gone into Santa Monica rather than...
Well, at least it's an outstanding journalist like Warren Olney, so I'm in good company with using his name for me. Let me share some other comments. We're almost out of time here. Elizabeth in Pacific Palisades says, I support splitting up neighborhoods. Parents have been trying to make this happen for a long time. Lots of bureaucratic obstacles and wasted resources we have to implement because it's mandatory. I think this would help parents feel more involved and have a voice. Aviva in West LA says, I think decentralization is great. The bureaucracy has gotten out of control. Principals knew their communities and teachers better. They should have that power to make those decisions. Paul in Lomita says, I'm a parent. We've been down this road before with LAUSD. It didn't work before. Going back 20 years with the mini local districts, it hasn't increased student achievement. It didn't work. And Hans in Eagle Rock says, I'm not in support of this. Breaking up schools is a distraction. It raises deep concerns about inequity and segregation with division of districts and lack of oversight. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I want to thank all of our guests for spending a good portion of this hour with us. Coming up, second hour, we'll again bring you up to date on what's happening out at polling places.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on this big election day across the United States. And of course, here in Southern California, where we've got a number of big congressional races that may determine which party is the majority in the House of Representatives. We've also got all the big statewide ballot propositions, 11 of them, to be decided, from bond measures to rent control to repealing the gas tax, much, much more, and the statewide offices as well, including like the U.S. Senate race with Dianne Feinstein being challenged by Kevin DeLeon, two Democrats going head-to-head because of the peculiarities of California's top two primary race. But let's talk about where the action is right now. That's at the polling locations. One of my favorite guests over the many years of hosting Air Talk is the great children's writer Marie Sendak, who so many of us as adults enjoy as well. Just a wonderful chance to talk with him over the years on Air Talk. And at Marie Sendak Elementary School's library in North Hollywood is Sharon McNary, KPCC reporter. Good morning, Sharon.
That's right. I am where the wild things are.
Where the wild things are. What a great place for people to get to vote. And if you had a chance, talk with some of the folks there.
Well, and it is so charming. They'll march an entire class of first grade kids past the open door of the Marie Sendak School Library, and they'll peek in, and the voting staff will wave at them. So I guess it's an early introduction to voting. There's been a pretty steady stream of people coming in here. The polling inspector said she expected it to be pretty busy, so she had a few extra staff on duty for the voting today.
And have they been called into use, those extra folks, as best you can tell?
Early in the day, yeah, but now it's slowed down a little bit because, you know, people have to go to work, and not everybody's brave enough to take those 2 hours paid time off to go vote, as provided in California state law. Some employers actually pay you, but others let you take your vacation time without penalty. But, you know, I came here expecting to hear people talk about Prop 10, which is a statewide issue that could have a lot of local impact. That's that rent control measure. And, you know, I'm not hearing a lot about it, surprisingly. There's
okay.
A lot of apartments here in North Hollywood.
Yeah.
I chose the place.
Yeah, and it's an area that's seen, like, the rest of Southern California, dramatic increases in rent in North Hollywood, too, and a lot of the newer construction that could be subject to rent control under Prop 10. So it's interesting that doesn't seem to be top of mind.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things that could kind of open up local cities and counties to enact rent control on more modern housing. You know, and it was a very expensive election. The people I'm talking to are actually more interested in kind of the national issues, immigration, taxes, some of the statewide issues like the gas tax potential repeal. Those are actually getting a little bit more traction from the people I'm talking to.
All right. Very good. And I hear the kids there in the background. So sounds like they're right there as the public comes to vote.
It's like watching a popcorn parade because they just can't walk. You know, they just pop up and down as they go by.
That sounds cute. Hey, Sharon, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You bet.
KPCC reporter Sharon McNary at Marie Sendak Elementary School in North Hollywood. How cool would that be to go to a school with its named for Sendak? I love that. Also with us, Kaylee Wells, who is at the Rancho del Sol Clubhouse in Westminster. Now, she's right where the action is, the 48th District. This is where longtime incumbent Republican Dana Rohrabacher is facing a challenge from very well well-funded Democrat Harley Rudup, just millions of dollars have been pumped into this race, and Rudup's supporters have way outspent Rohrabacher's supporters in this race. So, Kaylee, are you seeing a lot of people there in Westminster?
Well, I have to admit, I had to pull over just before I got to the polling place to get on the call, so I actually haven't been able to set eyes on the line here.
Okay, grab your binoculars and look down the street. And see.
I know. I gotta actually find it too. I'm in a big parking lot at the moment, but I'm nearby.
All right, very, very good. So this is a big race, though, in this North Orange County, or I should say coastal Orange County district, which extends from the north in Seal Beach all the way down into Newport Beach. So much is riding on this.
That's right, yeah. It all centers right around the Huntington Beach area. It's really sort of the classic Orange County. It's what people think of, I think, when you think of Orange County, especially in the coastal areas. It's affluent. It's been Republican for decades. And then Hillary Clinton won this congressional district by 2 points. So Ruta, he was actually a Republican when he donated to Kasich's campaign in 2016, and then he supported Hillary Clinton against Trump. So that's the person that's going against incumbent Dana Rohrabacher. I think it'll be interesting to see if voters were surprised by Clinton's victory in this district in 2016, as I was, and if they think that that's going to be happening again in 2018.
All right. So this, another big money race. We were just talking with Sharon McNary about, all the big stuff going on with the statewide measures, the amount of money that's poured in. But these congressional races are just seeing record spending and Democrats just blowing away Republicans when it comes to the amount of money that has been spent on these campaigns. Kaylee, thanks so much. We appreciate it. We'll let you get on to the Westminster location there, Rancho del Sol Clubhouse. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks so much.
Kaylee Wells with us on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. And we also wanted to check in, get a quick sense of what's happening in San Diego County. There, you've got a couple of big districts, the 49th and the 50th, that are in play. Megan Burks of KPBS, our fellow NPR member station, is at the Sherman Heights polling location. So, Megan, give us a sense of enthusiasm there.
Hi there. Well, yeah, we actually decided to post up here, which is not in one of those big races. Here, it's the 51st Congressional District, which is represented by Juan Vargas. And there's really no question that he is going to, again, win his seat this year. This district is overwhelmingly Democratic. But we wanted to come here because this is really the epicenter when we're talking about immigration as a country. We're talking about this district. This district ends at the U.S.-Mexico border. And so even though Juan Vargas is a shoo-in, a lot of people wanted to come out to vote today just to make sure that they made sure that he was indeed a shoo-in, but also to kind of stake their claim to being a part of this conversation. It's a bit like being in the room and having two people talk about you while you're there, and you're like, hey, I'm here. And it was, I think, people wanting to be a part of that conversation and say, hey, we live these binational lives. We live right here at the border. When you're talking about sending troops here, that's our community. When you're talking about the caravan coming here, that's our community. And we're, quite aware of what it's like to go through the ports of entry and how that asylum process might work out.
All right, Megan, thanks so much for giving us the flavor, the sense of what's happening there in Sherman Heights in San Diego County, which is part of the 51st Congressional District. Juan Vargas, the Democratic incumbent, represents that district. Megan Burks of KPBS San Diego. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC all day long. Election coverage on 89.3, but it really gets going seriously 5 o'clock, NPR's live coverage. You're going to be hearing as the polls close along the East Coast, those election returns start coming in from those big congressional races, the gubernatorial races like Georgia and Florida, where those could change parties, very significant races, senatorial races, all of that coming from NPR at 5. Libby Dankman and I will be joining you at 8 o'clock tonight with our statewide and local coverage as a part of the whole mix with NPR. It's Air Talk on KPCC. I'll be back with you in just a moment. Well, a very unpleasant scene that was captured on student cell phone video. A 14-year-old student at Maywood Academy High School standing next to his high school music teacher using a racial epithet and throwing a basketball at the teacher. The African-American teacher, following the epithet being said multiple times, punched the boy in the face and kept swinging on the student as other students recorded the incident. Then school officials intervened, pulled the teacher away from the student. 64-year-old Marston Riley, a teacher at Maywood Academy High School, was arrested on suspicion of child abuse. The investigation continues. But my question for you as an AirTalk listener is, how should schools deal with something like this? So you've got a case here where the teacher told the student to leave the room because he allegedly was not dressed properly in the school uniform for class. The student gets right up into the teacher's face, uses racial epithets, throws the basketball at him, and the teacher loses it and starts swinging on the student. If you were in charge of disciplining for this, dealing with this, how would you deal with it? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. LA Unified District officials said they're cooperating with the Sheriff's Department investigation into the matter, said we take this very seriously and do not condone violence or intolerance of any kind. That's the district statement. With me is Nick Salerno, adjunct faculty member at Cal Poly Pomona's School of Education. He teaches the Educational Administration Credential Program there, and he's former superintendent of the El Monte Union High School District and former principal of El Monte High School. Thank you so much, Mr. Salerno. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure. It's an honor to be with you.
This is obviously troubling on multiple levels. But in a case like this, we've had a defense fund that's been started on behalf of the teacher because, you know, I think there are people that sympathize with the teacher and him having to deal with that. Not that anyone condones physical violence against a student, but can you give us a sense of the difficulty from a disciplinary standpoint navigating this?
Sure. I think there's multiple levels of disciplinary action that will come. And it is a very, it's a difficult situation, and it really is truly a sad situation. So first off, let's start with the student's behavior. Absolutely inexcusable. No teacher should have to tolerate that type of behavior from a student. Obviously, I only know what I saw on the news and what I've read about it. So there's a lot of things I don't know that may have led up to this, but what I did hear the student saying and what I read about him throwing the basketball at the teacher, that is inexcusable. That being said, as professional educators, we are held to a high standard, and though I empathize and I understand the teacher's frustration and anger, I totally understand that. We cannot allow ourselves to get so emotional to where we take that type of action where we're actually striking and repeatedly hitting a student. That also is inexcusable.
Yeah, it's just so, I think, you know, so many of us can empathize with the teacher and how aggrieved he must have felt. And the anger that he must have felt in that circumstance. And yet, as you say, the law's clear and professional decorum and standards are very clear. You never strike a student. Now, maybe there would be some argument of self-defense of some kind. I don't know. You don't really see that in the video, but you raise an important point. We see a very short snippet here. And it's important with any video to understand there may be context that we're actually missing, which sheds further light on this incident. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Obviously, it's a terrible circumstance. The behavior of the student that we see and what is further alleged is unconscionable, and the teacher physically punching a student, not acceptable either. How do we go forward? What is appropriate discipline? 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about the unfortunate incident in Maywood at Maywood Academy High School, where a student who was supposedly not in uniform, not dressed the appropriate way for the school, came into the music class. The longtime music teacher there told the student to leave because he wasn't dressed in uniform. The student walks up to the teacher, throws a basketball at him, and uses racial epithets directed toward the African-American teacher. The teacher loses control, goes after the student, punches him. Finally, school personnel pulled the teacher off of the student. The student was taken to a medical facility. Not sure if it was a full-on hospital, but was given medical treatment and treated, according to the sheriff's department, for moderate injuries and released. The teacher, 64-year-old Marston Riley, was arrested, booked at the East L.A. Sheriff Station. He was released the following morning. That was Saturday morning after posting $50,000 bail. He's scheduled for arraignment late this month. So obviously he's not going to be returning to the classroom anytime soon, but I have multiple questions. Should the teacher be banned from teaching again because he lost it and physically attacked a student at this point? Does that invalidate the long career, the fact that students have, at least according to the LA Times reporting from Haley Branson Potts, have come to the defense of the teacher and say that they think he's a strong teacher and someone they like and respect? Obviously, it's serious to punch and to injure a student, as happened here. But let me ask our guest, Nick Salerno, who's been a superintendent and a principal. Can the teacher in this case, once the legal case is disposed of, could the teacher possibly resume his career?
Well, I can only speak from past experience and things that I've experienced firsthand in dealing with our school district. Honestly, we've never had a situation like this, but there are incidences that have occurred that I've been aware of in other places. Honestly, I don't think that this teacher will end up returning to the classroom. And the reason I say that, typically these situations will be forwarded to the California Credential, California Commission on Teaching Credentials. They convene, they review cases like this, they can make a determine whether to suspend or revoke a teacher's credential. And if they decide to revoke that credential, he would not be able to teach again.
Well, and I assume there's also a liability issue because, so let's say he kept his credential and maybe not this district, but another district, you know, were to employ him. The challenge, the exposure for them is if, heaven forbid, it happened a second time, the lawsuits that potentially would come to say, well, you hired someone who, you know, had this incident of striking a student before. It just seemed to me that the exposure to a future employer could be high.
Well, absolutely, because then the argument could be made, well, you had prior knowledge.
Yeah.
That this person exhibited this type of behavior. And again, as you said, God forbid that this were to happen again, the district would be in a very bad position legally. And not to mention, you know, if it did happen again, another issue with possible injury to a student. So even though, as I said earlier, I totally understand the teacher's frustration, anger, and I can empathize with those things, as professional educators, we cannot behave in that manner.
All right. Let's take a listener call. This comes from James in Covina. James, I understand you've contributed to the GoFundMe page that was set up to help pay the teacher's legal expenses.
Yeah, frankly, I feel bad for the guy because classically, I feel like this is the first time this kid has learned a lesson in his life. And unfortunately, it came at such a costly expense, if you will. As far as what can be done with the teacher himself, I think at 64, he can be given a way out, basically. I don't think he deserves a full punishment, but he should be given a way out of teaching, a retirement package, something to where he can leave in peace. I don't think he can return to the classroom, period. But as far as the kid, I'm surprised the parents are even pressing any kind of charges, because what he did was terrible, and he learned a lesson through the process. And I think, frankly, the parents should be thankful that he learned a lesson. But I understand that the aggression is not acceptable, and the teacher should be given some way out of teaching, but I don't imagine him returning to the classroom either.
James, I appreciate it. And I don't know that the parents of the student have made any statement at all, and they wouldn't have to push for prosecution. This is something where the district attorney's office they could make the decision to prosecute irrespective of what the parents wanted. This was witnessed by a group of students. It was, at least a portion of it was videotaped. So that would not be required, that the parents want any action taken or not taken. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to Nick Salerno, who teaches in the credentialing program, Cal Poly Pomona. What about the student here? And I would think there's the potential, you know, not just for the student to be criminally prosecuted for this, but also for, could the student ever come back to the school after an incident like this? Or would it depend on the student's prior disciplinary background, if there is any?
Well, those are all good points you raised, Larry. So, yes, the student's prior record would be reviewed, and that would be taken into consideration either way. But I think in most cases, in the districts that I've known and worked with, typically incidents like this, they, in addition to how drastic this situation is, it causes huge distractions on campus. And, you know, students will continue to talk about it. It affects the morale of the school, the staff, the students, everyone. So typically, the student has some choices. I can't say whether this is an expellable offense because I don't know all the facts. It's definitely a suspendable offense. But I think if it were me trying to have to work through this situation, I think I would look at moving the student to another school after the suspension ends, or even if it's an expulsion after the term of expulsion ends, moving the student to a different setting, giving the student a fresh start, not bringing back the distraction and feelings that could surface back to the school, I think would be negative for students and staff. So I think in working with the family, trying to alleviate all of that for the student and the other people at the school, and getting a fresh start in another setting. Sometimes that's thing for everyone involved.
Do you ever recall an incident where you had a student who used a racial slur towards a faculty or staff member?
You know, I honestly can't. I've had situations where students have used language they shouldn't have used in the classroom directed at the teacher. Typically, when we bring the parents in, the parents are supportive. And I think one of the most important things in the situation, I've found through experience, when those types of things happen, it's really important for the parent to know exactly what was said, because if you just tell the parent, well, you know, the student used some bad language with the teacher, well, that could mean anything.
Sure, yeah. So you think be specific and let them hear the noxious words that came out of their child's, yeah. Let me take another listener call. Let's talk with Lenny in the Miracle Mile District. You're on Air Talk.
Yeah, so one of the things that's not considered is that this doesn't just happen. There is a history, and there's a lot of behavior that kids exhibit that's never dealt with in a timely manner, and they wait for an event where something like this explodes. The school district has an inherent conflict of interest because it collects money for average daily attendance based on attendance. So instead of intervening at an earlier time where this student obviously exhibited this kind of behavior before, they let it go on. A teacher has a full-time job trying to teach a class and cannot be put in a situation where kids who have been systematically socially promoted grade after grade without mastering grade level standards is in a situation where education has actually become humiliating, and they become disruptive and they act out. This is becoming the rule, not the exception, and nobody wants to talk about it because we're still living in a society where 64 years after Brown versus Board of Education, we have a segregated school system where white people don't go to the same schools that black and brown children go to. And so people still have racial prejudice and all sorts of things that were not passed in this country.
Lenny, appreciate your call. Thank you very much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And Ron tweets at Air Talk, I was hit a number of times by teachers. A kid didn't kill me. I had it coming. I knew it. Well, that may be in your case. Obviously, you can't operate schools with a policy of allowing teachers to use physical force like that against students. Matthew in Studio City says the great example as to why teachers need some type of panic button that calls security guards and extra help when a situation escalates. Ann in Inglewood wondering, could the teacher sue the student? Could it be considered a hate crime because the student called him a word? I don't think words like that would qualify that you could sue on those grounds. As reprehensible as using language like that is, maybe for throwing the basketball at him, because that's an actual physical action. But what the teacher's dealing with is obviously a much bigger issue than whether he turns around and sues the student at this point. And again, it'd be so helpful to know if the student had any sort of a prior record, what the degree of trouble the student might have had prior to this. Al, in La Cunada, Flint Ridge, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, I absolutely side with the teacher. When as a father of two teenagers, if you can't raise your child, you should expect society to teach them right from wrong in a very harsh way. And in this case, the aggression started with the student and not the teacher. And unfortunately, in our society, insulting one another with racial slurs has become so normal that people are now talking about expelling the teacher. I just don't understand why that should even be a conversation.
Well, because you can't strike a student, because that puts the district in a terrible legal position. So no one's saying that it's acceptable for a student to use racial slurs against a teacher, but you just can't have a teacher physically punch a student like that.
Started with the student, right?
No, the student threw the basketball, but the student didn't take the swing first. The teacher took the first swing. We'll continue. We'll take more listener calls. We're at 866-893-KPCC. I should say on the video, the teacher takes the first swing. I can't say what happens before the video starts shooting, so I should correct and make that very clear. All we see is what's recorded. Who knows what additional context there may be? We'll be back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Just want to remind you that you can come by because KPCC's in-person team's in our Crawford Family Forum just steps away from me right now. It's our Democracy and Donuts on Election Day. Drop by, come by, get free coffee, donuts, pastries. Stick around for some casual conversation with your fellow KPCC listeners or with our KPCC staff members who are there. More information on our location is kpcc.org/in-person. We hope you'll take a moment to come by on this election day and join us at the Crawford Family Forum. Right now, we're talking about a very unfortunate incident Friday at Maywood Academy High School, a classroom there, a music teacher who has been teaching for many years, 64-year-old Marston Riley, asked a student who was apparently not wearing the school uniform to leave the classroom. The student refused, walked up on the teacher, threw a basketball that he had in his hand at the teacher, and used racial epithets directed toward the African-American teacher. The teacher started punching the student, hit him, punched him as he went to the ground, was pulled off by school personnel. The teacher was arrested, booked at the East L.A. Sheriff's Station, held overnight, and released Saturday morning after posting bail. He'll go back for arraignment on November 30th. The question is, what is the best way to deal with this for the teacher, for the student who was involved? How do you deal with a case like this? So many things wrong. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Phil in Culver City. Phil, I understand that you were a substitute teacher. Your thoughts on what happened here?
I think this teacher really had a responsibility. And I think all teachers have a responsibility, not just to instruct in their subject, but to create a learning environment that facilitates teaching on all learning opportunities that come in the classroom. And I think this teacher should face the full repercussions of the law, should lose their job, and should not be allowed to teach, despite some other comments on the show, because he had an opportunity to teach other students in that classroom how an adult who is that old can learn and should handle instances of this type of hate speech, regardless of if a 14-year-old child is using appropriate language. I think that the real failing of this teacher is not instructing those other students in the classroom of how to deal with a situation like this, such as calling for backup, trying to take the student aside and converse about the differences, in some way trying to facilitate the situation without violence. But instead they failed at that, and they showed a whole classroom full of 13, 14, and 15-year-olds that violence is the way that you solve your problem.
Phil, do you have empathy for the teacher? And again, let's take a hypothetical, because we don't have the specifics on the relationship of this student to this teacher. But if you've got a teacher, let's say, who's had a fraught relationship with a student who has been routinely disrespectful, unresponsive, rude, disruptive in the class, are you empathetic with the teacher just, you know, that this may not be isolated and just finally loses it?
I'm sorry, I unfortunately don't. I mean, my last name's Potter, so I was a substitute teacher that wrote Mr. Potter up on the board every day. You can imagine how many laughs and jokes and things like that I get. That is expected par for the course, and it is your responsibility as an adult, as an educator, and as a teacher to figure out different ways to facilitate that relationship.
All right.
That means reaching out to parents or school counselors or the resources that you have available. But this person is professionally trained on how to deal with those situations, just like I was when getting my credential. So students curse at you. They yell at you. I've got erasers thrown at me. But at the end of the day, their responsibility is to serve all of the students in the classroom, not react to one.
All right. I appreciate it, Phil. Thank you so much. Let's talk next with Anthony in the Fairfax District. I understand you also donated to the GoFundMe page set up on the teacher's behalf.
Yeah, that's right. First, I'd like to say that, I mean, what the teacher did was deplorable and shocking. I was very shocked when I
saw the initial reports from local media, who unfortunately did not show the full video, the longer video. And once I saw the longer video, I gained some empathy for the teacher. I still believe that he should be punished to some extent. I still believe he was wrong. The violence is not the answer. But responding to the previous caller, I think the student's egregious actions and violence, by the way, he threw a basketball at the teacher and tried to start a fight with him. He was egging him on to fight him. We're not just talking about a teacher, a kid who's making fun of a teacher's last name. I mean, it's kind of silly to compare that with what this teacher went through. This was the most egregious act I've ever seen a student commit. And I think they're both at fault. And I would hope that I think that both need to be punished. But the teacher, I think he should be allowed to teach again after being, you know, maybe he has to take some therapy and do something. But I don't think he should go to jail. And I don't think he should be banned from teaching. I think when you actually watch the longer video, you will see how egregious the student was. He did something I've never seen in my life. And I've been around some pretty rude people. I would just like to add that, again, the media's initial reporting of this, I think, was very irresponsible. They showed a clip that only showed the teacher fighting. They did not show what he had to go through, what he endured before then.
Yeah.
And I think that was irresponsible.
Anthony, I appreciate it. Thank you for being with us. Anthony in the Fairfax District. Let me just share a couple of other comments from listeners. Daniel in Van Nuys called to say, I'm a professor at a community college. It's just not acceptable to touch your student under any circumstances, particularly given that the teacher continued to punch the student once he went to the ground. Adam in Highland Park says, callers are siding with the teacher. I'm a college student, and I'd be extremely upset if a teacher could do that at my school. Teachers should be trained, have professional knowledge, and be a bigger person rather than turning to physical assault of a student. That's Adam in Highland Park. And Tony in Echo Park says, I think it's completely on the teacher. The teacher should be suspended for the action. There should also be mediation between the student and teacher. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. And I want to thank Nick Salerno of Cal Poly Pomona. He teaches there in the Educational Administration Credentialing Program and has plenty of real-world experience, former superintendent of the El Monte Union High School District and the former principal of El Monte High School. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about where we stand 10 games in to our NBA season, our local teams, the Lakers led by LeBron James, the Clippers led by a cast without the big stars of years past. We'll talk about how they're doing so far in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Reminder that our election coverage begins this afternoon on KPCC. All things considered, taking us up to the poll closings on the East Coast. 5 o'clock when they close on the East. NPR begins its continuous coverage then. And Libby Dankman will be with me starting at 8 o'clock with our coverage of all the local election returns after the polls close at 8 o'clock here in California. That's tonight. We'll go late into the evening with the returns as we have them. We continue our conversation with the start of the NBA season. A highly anticipated year for the Lakers as they get the best free agent by far, LeBron James, historic figure in the NBA, but a bit of a stumble out of the gate, going 4-6. Young players who surround LeBron in the lineup, as well as some recent arrivals. And the Clippers, meanwhile, without their triumvirate of stars, starts 6-4 and is actually in an early playoff position. With me is reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who covers the Lakers, Tanya Ganguly. Tanya, good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start first with a little of the backstage drama. ESPN broke the story late last week that Magic Johnson called Luke Walton, the Laker coach, into his office and berated him in a very animated way over the team's rough start. What can you add about the relationship between Magic Johnson, who's in charge of the club, and his coach?
Well, my colleagues, Brad Turner, Bill Plaschke, and I were kind of standing in Staples Center on Sunday night, and this was their first home game since that news had broken. They had played in Portland the night before, and the three of us were standing there, and Magic Johnson actually happened to be walking through. We were by a door that leads up to where he goes to get to his suite, and he happened to walk through and stop to talk to us. And he, you know, one of the things that he told us was that this is something that they've all moved on for. But what struck me was that he really, there was no sense of regret for him. He felt like he's got a job to do and that's what needed to be done. What we heard about that conversation is that one thing, what surprised people was that Magic was so angry during it. I mean, we heard details that he was screaming and cursing at Walton, and Walton tried to interject something and he got scolded for interrupting. It was that kind of conversation. But both sides have said that they've kind of moved on from it. And in terms of Walton's job security, that was sort of the implication when the story first broke, that people were worried about Walton's job security. The one thing that we all kept hearing, that I've kept hearing through my reporting, is that this was never about Luke Walton's job security. It was about specific issues that Magic Johnson has with the team.
Well, and let me ask you, because you travel, you see every game as the beat reporter. It just seems to me, in what I've caught of their actions so far, there still are not set units. And, you know, part of that were the suspensions to Brandon Ingram and Rajon Rondo. But is Luke Walton intending to develop more set lineups? Has he spoken about that?
Well, one of the things that Magic Johnson talked to him about was wanting to see an offensive system in place. And, you know, that's a subject that has a lot of different viewpoints on it. Some people say that LeBron James isn't the kind of player who plays in a system. You know, Luke Walton's offense has never really been about a system. So those are some things that come into play here. I do think that LeBron would like to see at some point in the season them having a consistent starting five. But Luke Walton has over the last couple of years shown that he's willing to try things and willing to sort of see what works and see what he can do in terms of which groups play well together. You have to remember they have one star on the team right now, LeBron James, and everybody else is a young guy. There's all these different, you know, when they told us at the beginning, before the season started, they told us there's only one starting spot that's for sure. I would say there are actually two, because there's center JaVale McGee. They don't really have another person of his caliber who can do that.
Who's looked good.
Other than that, they've been trying a lot of different things.
Yeah, I've been surprised. McGee's looked quite good, although they've been having to have him log heavy minutes with Tyson Chandler arriving. That'll give him a backup to spell him a little bit. Before I let you go, what's your sense of LeBron James and his degree of frustration 10 games in?
I think he's surveying the scene right now. That's how it feels to me. This conversation that Magic Johnson and Luke Walton had that became big news had nothing to do with LeBron. You know, it wasn't something that Johnson talked to LeBron about. It wasn't something that LeBron asked for. He has not been complaining about the coaching. I think he's sort of just trying to look around and observe and see, form his opinions about how things are going. I don't think he is at a point where he's getting frustrated with the plan right now.
Tanya, thank you so much. Great to talk with you. I hope we can check in with you at multiple points this season. That'd be terrific.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Los Angeles Times Lakers reporter Tanya Ganguly with us. Also joining us, the Times Clippers beat reporter Andrew Greif. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So this is a team that had its big three stars that have all moved on elsewhere. So you're a team, the team here that's in rebuilding mode. It's a bit surprising that they're 6-4 and actually very early in the season, but sitting in a playoff position.
I don't know if the people around the team would say it's all that surprising, because while they are in a season of transition moving on from that Lob City era, they didn't bottom out like some teams do when they're rebuilding. They wanted to stay competitive this year. And so they kind of, in the offseason, they built a lineup that was very deep, albeit with no clear superstar. I think that they have high hopes for a guy like Tobias Harris, a forward who's been very consistent this season, potentially even Danilo Gallinari, another forward. But there's really no alpha in the way that there is with the Lakers, for example. With this team, they rely on their depth and changing lineups, and they think that they can kind of mix and match and play enough defense to keep them in a playoff hunt.
This team that in the past has had with its three stars of the, you know, two big stars for a good part of last year, three stars the year prior, a little bit of discord and some big egos. Is this team sort of finding a personality, or is it too early for that?
No, it definitely has a personality. And Doc Rivers, the coach who oversaw those teams that could be fractious at times in the past years, as you alluded to, has said over and over how much he enjoys coaching this team, because without the big superstar, there hasn't been kind of a power play of egos in the locker room. For the most part right now, even when guys have been demoted out of the starting lineup, like center Marcin Gortat the other day, he said that he took it well. To him, that was a sign that guys are willing to kind of accept a little bit of pain for the betterment of the team. That's not always the case. I think the bigger point about the identity, though, is that they have said over and over that they would like to be a team that pesters opponents with very hard defense and essentially makes your life miserable when you play them. They don't want to be a team that you enjoy playing against. In the past, that meant something very different, because the Clippers could be an unlikable team nationally. But now they want to do it in a way that, they want to kind of grit you to death, is one of the things I've been told.
All right. Thank you so much, Andrew. Really appreciate your updating us early in the season on what's happening with the LA Clippers.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andrew Greif is the beat writer for the Clippers for the LA Times. And we end with the national basketball writer for the Times, Dan Wieke. Dan, good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well. So it seems like there's an explosion of offense 10 games into the season. What's going on league-wide?
Well, I think it's sort of the math has started to make sense to everybody. And it's math that's been there for years, but it really started with the Golden State Warriors kind of unlocking it 4 or 5 years ago with their uptick in three-point attempts. And there's been sort of a league-wide movement to either shoot really three kinds of shots. You want to shoot three-pointers, you want to shoot layups, or you want to shoot free throws. And because that's the mathematics, those are the highest percentage shots. They give you the best return. You don't want to get caught kind of in between. And I think what we've seen teams do that, we've seen teams play faster. And when those shots are available earlier in the shot clock, they take them. And we've seen kind of, the defensive rule books kind of also be rewritten. The game is being officiated differently. Players are not allowed to hold as much and grab as much when guys move off the ball. And so that's out of the free throws. I think we're at, 4 or 5 points more per game this season. Three-point attempts are on a record-setting pace again, which has been a trend every season here for the last half decade or so. And it's made coaches, I think, and this is what I find most interesting, kind of reevaluate what good defense looks like on the scoreboard.
Yeah, it's got to be a sliding scale, right? You can't, trying to hold a team under 100, not going to happen. Dan, thanks so much. That's Dan Wieke, national basketball writer for the Los Angeles Times. Have a wonderful afternoon. I'm back with you 8 o'clock tonight with our election coverage.